prepared to talk. Thanks.
We had to reshuffle some of the contributed talks. The contributed talks are all the same people, all the same titles, but in a little bit different order. I think if your talk was in danger of being moved, I have at least warned you of that possibility and okayed it with you. So the changes are in contributed session 1, contributed session 3, and contributed session 4. I've put up the new schedule here. It is also now posted outside on the board, and I understand there are extra copies that you can pick up if you like. So, if anyone has any questions, please ask me. But this new schedule should be final, and there have been no changes in the invited talks, just in the contributed sessions 1, 3, and 4.
Okay. Good. So our second talk of the afternoon is by Ana Flanagan. Ana got his PhD at Caltech, did a postdoc with Bob Wald at Chicago, and is now on the faculty at Cornell. He is also one of these people who is rather diverse, ranging from work on the engineering design of baffles to control scattered light in the LIGO beam tubes, which I presume is what you'll discuss largely today, to issues in quantum field theory and curved space-time. But his topic today is about gravitational wave detection prospects and challenges.
Hello, can you hear me? Okay. I'll just put them to the side. Okay, so I'd like to start off by explaining why a talk on gravitational wave detection is apparently completely out of place at a conference on quantum and classical properties of strong gravitational fields. So, let me remind you of two well-known aspects of the gravitational waves that we're hoping to detect. First of all, as you know, they're extremely weak fields. The dimensionless metric perturbations we're going to detect are of order 10 to the minus 21 or 10 to the minus 22 or 10 to the minus 23, so they're by no means strong field. And the other well-known thing is that they're extremely classical. To have any hope of detecting gravitational waves, the occupation number per mode of the gravitational waves we're trying to detect has to be extremely large, of order 10 to the 20 or 10 to the 30 or something like that. So it would seem naively that this subject is completely out of place at this conference. Of course, when you think about it a little, it's obvious from another point of view that gravitational waves is exactly what we want to talk about at this conference. Because gravitational waves potentially provide our best window into strong gravitational fields, both the classical properties and perhaps even the quantum properties. So the basic idea is that when we follow the gravitational waves we see in our detectors back along an all geodesic through the universe to whatever source produced them, then often those sources will be strong field sources, very relativistic, because those are the typically the sources that will be the strongest in our detectors. So things like black holes in the early universe. The enterprise of gravitational wave astronomy has a lot of different sort of areas of effort. Let me talk about some of them. There's a huge experimental effort in a lot of different areas that's been going on for many, many years. There's an effort on data analysis, understanding all the details of the methods of data analysis and what the complexities are for the different types of waves. And that's been gaining steam over the last 2 years, and it's pretty much up to speed now to be ready for when the detectors go online. Then there's general relativity and astrophysics and source modeling, which ties into data analysis and ties into what we think the hopeful waves will come from. And of course, at the end of the day, we hope to combine all of these things together and learn interesting things. We hope to learn about possibly fundamental physics. We hope to learn a lot of astronomy, astrophysics and phenomenology, and cosmology. So those are the ultimate goals. In this talk today, I'm going to sort of ignore all of this stuff up here, which is where the kind of detailed stuff that I work on myself. And I'll try and focus on this regime down here, which I think will be of most interest to this audience. So I'm going to try and focus on what we can learn from gravitational waves, and focus in particular on strong fields and fundamental physics we can learn, rather than sort of phenomenology in astrophysics. So here's an overview of what I'm going to talk about. First of all, I'll give you a brief overview of where the experimental effort is at today, what's the sort of current situation and the prospects. Then I'll talk about what do we know so far about gravitational waves observationally. And currently we have upper limits in a number of different frequency bands by a number of different techniques, and one indirect detection, which I'll talk about. I'm going to spend a little while later on in the talk talking about a type of detection method that that's an indirect detection method, which is the possibility of detecting gravitational waves via their influence in the cosmic microwave background, because that sort of ties in with some of the more exciting strong field sources of gravitational waves that I'll be talking about. So I'll spend a little while discussing the feasibility of this type of indirect detection. The main part of the talk is going to be sort of like a review of various gravitational wave sources. But I'm not going to try and give a balanced or comprehensive review of gravitational wave sources, because I think this community has seen such reviews before, and a lot of the subject doesn't change very dramatically from year to year. So what I am going to try and do is give you sort of a unbalanced review, where I pick out certain things that I think are interesting. And in particular, when I go through various sources, I'm going to try and keep three themes in mind that I'm going to try and emphasize or try and that will guide my selection of things to talk about. First of all, what can we learn about strong field gravity, very relativistic systems? Second, what are the recent developments in the last year or two that some of you might not have heard about in all of the different areas, including source modeling, data analysis, and so on? And thirdly, what are the outstanding theoretical issues in general relativity and source modeling that are sort of blocking an impediment to our progress today? So I'm going to try and raise some of these issues to hopefully spark some discussion in the later section. When one considers sources of gravitational waves, you can classify these sources in a number of different ways. The first obvious way is the character of the gravitational wave. Is it well-defined in the time domain, so it's what they call a burst wave? Is it well-defined in the frequency domain, so it's periodic or almost periodic? Or is it neither? And so if it's neither well-defined in the time domain nor the frequency domain, then typically we can only understand it and model its creation in a statistical way, and so we treat it as a stochastic source. The second way of classifying gravitational wave sources is by their frequency. So the sources that we have conceived of for gravitational waves span an enormous range of frequencies, from about 10 to the minus 18 hertz up to about 10 to the 9 hertz. And so there are all these different frequency bands where we possibly could detect waves. The third method of classifying different types of sources is basically how strong the waves are going to be. In other words, what's the dimensionless amplitude of the strongest wave of that type that we'll see one per year? So this measure is a simultaneous measure of the strength of the waves and the event rate, and that's the relevant thing that we're interested in. And so this is sort of the parameter space that we're working in, strength of waves or event rate, frequency. So there are also two additional ways that we can classify gravitational wave sources that are important. Another dimension is, how sure are we that this particular type of source exists? Is it very certain and very firm and we're really quite certain? Or is it something very, very speculative and we really have no idea? It's sort of like a guess that something wild that might happen. And so there's a huge range in anticipated gravitational wave sources along this sort of axis. And another related axis is the axis of what can we hope to learn from gravitational wave sources. We can hope to learn things like the rate of formation of neutron stars, perhaps things like what the value of the Hubble constant is. And we can classify the types of things we can learn according to whether or not it's sort of phenomenology or is it towards the level of fundamental physics. And these last two ways of classifying the waves are sort of correlated. The sources of waves that tend to be more speculative are also the sources of waves that have the potential for teaching us more. And in this talk, I'm going to try and concentrate a little bit on the more speculative and possibly more interesting sources that we're not really so sure about and we may not detect. But for this audience, I thought that would be more interesting. So I'm going to start with an overview of the experiment effort to date. So as you know, the two dominant technologies for pursuing gravitational wave detection are, first of all, monitoring the modes of vibration of solids. So these are the so-called bar detectors. And the situation today is that we have basically five operating cylindrical resonant mass detectors. And three of these detectors that are roughly similar, and two of them are detectors that are sort of more advanced and more recent. So the Allegro detector at Louisiana State University, the Niobe detector at University of Perth, and the Explorer detector at University of Rome all have temperatures of a few Kelvin and are sensitive to dimensionless strains, H, of order 10 to the minus 19 times a few. Then the more recent, more advanced detectors, the Auriga detector and the Nautilus detector, both in Italy, they're more advanced because they're cooler, the temperatures of order a few tens of millikelvin, and sensitivities of order a few times 10 to the minus 20. And then there's a subsequent generation of detectors currently in the planning stage, whose design is that they should be spherical detectors rather than cylinders, or possibly hollow spheres, or possibly truncated icosahedral gravitational arrays. So basically they're spheres except for their icosahedron. But these detectors have design sensitivities of order 10 to the minus 21, so they're many times better than the current generation. And the reason that these are hoped to be more sensitive are for two reasons. These detectors are essentially much larger than the previous generation of detectors, which helps you. And the second factor is that for these spherical detectors, one hopes to monitor not just one mode of vibration or two, but five orthogonal sort of quadrupolar modes of vibration of a sphere, and one gets basically five detectors for one. And that's another gain factor. So this is the current status of the interferometer detectors. So LIGO, the overall schedule for LIGO, the detector installation, should be done in 1999, and the engineering runs should be done in the next 2 years, 2000 and 2001. And the first science run is scheduled for 2002 to 2003, and the goal is to get 1 year's worth of data in that two-year time frame. The French-Italian Virgo detector in Italy originally was planned to come online around about the same time scale as LIGO, but it's been pushed back a little bit, and now it's going to come online a little bit later. The GEO detector in Germany is smaller and will come online around about 2001. And then there are other projects in Japan and in Australia that currently are building smaller scale sort of prototype detectors, but have plans for kilometer scale detectors in the future. Let me remind you that of the situation in the longer time scale for the possibility of having space-based interferometer detectors. So the LISA project has been improved, as you know, by the European Space Agency. It's part of its Horizon 2000 Plus program. And NASA is considering joining with ESA to help make this project happen. And so that the time when this project might actually fly is still somewhat uncertain, but it's certainly off in the distant future. And there is a competing proposal due to some people at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory called Omega, which proposes to put spacecraft in Earth orbit rather than in solar orbit, as is with the case for LISA, and it would be cheaper but less sensitive. Okay. So this is a summary of the sensitivities of the various detectors. These green curves and dots are what's been achieved experimentally to date. This is the LIGO 40-meter prototype detector at Caltech, 1994. These are sort of representative numbers for bar detectors in 1976, 1995, and the most recent generation that I was mentioning is somewhere around about here. This is the proposed next generation of spheres or truncated icosahedral gravitational arrays. These are initial and advanced LIGO noise curves, or as people now usually call them, LIGO 1 and LIGO 3. And over here I've plotted the projected noise curve for LISA, and I've also plotted in the point that corresponds to our indirect detection of gravitational waves from the binary pulsar. These points for the narrowband detectors, they're positioned on this graph at a point at which the detectability of gravitational waves, how strong they have to be detected, depends on their character, whether they're periodic or burst or stochastic. And these points are placed on this plot in such a way that burst waves will be equally easily detectable by these broadband instruments and the narrowband instruments when the position of the narrowband triangle is in the same vertical height as the broadband instrument. So for instance, looking at this picture tells you how easy it is to detect things like coalescing binaries, but if you wanted to think about periodic sources, this picture would be misleading. This is a more detailed picture of the upcoming ground-based laser interferometer detector noise curves. So this black line is the initial or LIGO 1 noise curve, and this red line that's substantially below it is LIGO 3, and then the next stage, what they call LIGO 2, is somewhere in here. It's not plotted. And these three other curves are then the other three projects that are currently being constructed: the Virgo curve, the GEO 600 curve, which is a factor of a few above the LIGO curve, and the TAMA 300 curve. So this is a picture taken from the LIGO website of taken within the last few months of the site in Hanford, Washington, showing the beam tubes. And so construction of the beam tubes is complete, and they're now installing the optics. I think the vegetation is somewhat sparse. I've actually been there, but I can't remember.
This picture is taken in the middle of the winter.
I see. There is vegetation. I see. Okay. Okay. This is a similar picture for the other LIGO site in Livingston, Louisiana. So this is the beam tube, and then that's the concrete enclosure.
So that one will also be finished by 1999?
I think the civil construction is already complete. So. Actually, I think there was an incident where there were some bullet holes discovered in one of the walls of one of the buildings.
Louisiana.
I think that was one of the main reasons for building this concrete enclosure, or at least one of the reasons, unfortunately. So. Pardon? Is that correct? Oh. No, not correct. Kip is indicating. Okay. So that's the situation with respect to the experiments. To discuss various types of sources and their detectability, let me introduce some notations. So as I mentioned, there are three different characters of gravitational waves: burst waves, periodic waves, and stochastic waves. And we can distinguish between a couple of different types of strain amplitude, this dimensionless quantity H that come in. So what I'm going to call H sub amp for amplitude T is just going to be the physical size of the metric perturbation for any type of source. So that's sort of unambiguous. For a particular detector, there's another unambiguous thing that's a dimensionless function of frequency, what they call HRMSF. So it's basically defined to be this quantity squared gives you the root mean square fluctuation per unit logarithmic frequency of the output of the detector. So one integrates this quantity squared with respect to logarithmic frequency, which is dimensionless, to give the fluctuations in the output of the detector. So this is a dimensionless measure of fluctuations as a function of frequency. For assessing detectability, we naively one would just compare these two numbers and see how well we do. But there are factors that come in related to how the data analysis procedure works. Basically, for some types of sources, you build up signal to noise with time as you do the data analysis. And the factors are slightly different for each different type of source. So for burst sources, there's an enhancement factor of the number of square root of the number of cycles in the waves, which is very important. And there's a reduction factor depending on how many individual starting times one needs. T is the duration of the observation, and delta T is the time resolution. And this is sort of a crude order of magnitude relation. So really, to assess detectability, you should give a more precise version of this. But for this talk, this gives the right idea. For periodic waves, there's a similar enhancement factor analogous to the number of cycles. It's the observation time times the frequency. And then there's a similar reduction factor depending on that comes from Gaussian statistics, or assumed Gaussian statistics, I should say. And for stochastic waves, then one has only the number of cycles times factor. These rough formula come from assumed Gaussian statistics, and the reason that one of the main reasons for having two detectors is that assumed Gaussian statistics won't be valid, but with several detectors, one can get into a regime where the non-Gaussian effect can be overcome. Let me remind you of a standard notation for gravitational wave strength. So for gravitational waves that are stochastic and also for generic gravitational waves at low frequencies, it's useful not to talk about the dimensionless amplitude of the wave, h, but instead to talk about the contribution of the energy in the waves to the total energy in the universe. So one has the omega parameter that one usually talks about in cosmology. And again, we can make this dimensionless by talking about an omega per unit logarithmic frequency. So this quantity is just energy density per unit logarithmic frequency divided by critical energy density to close the universe. And when one puts in the numbers, one finds that in the LIGO frequency band, an omega of 1 corresponds to a dimensionless amplitude of about 10 to the minus 20 in metric perturbation. Okay. So this is a summary of most of what we know observationally with respect to gravitational waves. So this now is a plot of frequency versus basically gravitational wave strength, now parameterized in terms of this quantity omega, and it's over a much huger range of frequencies than my previous plot, which only went down to about here. And so these are the LIGO and Leeson noise curves that we showed before, and now I've shown the upper limits that we get from different observations. The first upper limit comes from tracking spacecraft in the solar system and looking for Doppler shifts in the radio signals. The second upper limit comes from timing pulsars, and this limit basically is very precise because the timing residuals in pulsars are very, very small, of order of a microsecond, and the baseline over which you're working is the duration of the observation, about 10 years. And finally, there's a upper limit coming from the current observations of the microwave background anisotropies. I'll be coming back and talking about this in more detail later in the talk. Okay. So now we're going to switch gears and start going through various types of sources. And again, it's not going to be comprehensive, but it's going to be kind of scattered, picking out different issues here and there that may be interesting. So the first obvious strong field source is, of course, black holes, which is the main type of source for both space-based and ground-based detectors. So let's think for a little bit about systems of binary black holes. The event rate for ground-based detectors for binary black holes is somewhat uncertain. It's a lot more uncertain than the event rate for neutron star coalescences. But estimates that people have made suggest that it's roughly comparable or maybe a little bit lower than the event rate for neutron star coalescences. But it's uncertain because it's based on progenitor evolution scenarios rather than on observations. So there are several different classes of scenarios that give rise to black hole binaries, and people have estimated what what they think the event rate might be for the different classes. So there are black hole binaries formed in capture processes in globular clusters. There are black hole binaries formed in the field in the middle of the galaxy. And so there are various different categories. At much lower frequencies, one can consider coalescences of binary black holes in the range of frequencies relevant to LISA. And here there are two different broad categories. There's coalescences of supermassive black holes that might happen when galaxies merge. And then there's coalescences of a supermassive black hole with a small conventional solar mass black hole, in which case one has something like a coalescing binary. One has a gradual in-spiral of the small black hole into the supermassive black hole. This event rate for this has been recently estimated by Stein Sigurdsson, where he actually analyzes the population of the stellar population near the central black hole and makes plausible estimates for what the distribution of masses of stars of various sizes is, works through the calculation of how often stars get kicked down towards the black hole, and estimates an event rate for this process. And he gets a conservative estimate that there should be more than one event per year. So that's sort of his lower bound, and he thinks it's quite likely there's several events per year. So this is a promising source.
What's
SMBH? Supermassive black hole. Okay. So I'm going to focus on this type of source, the small black hole going into a large black hole, a little bit, because it's one of the avenues we have for getting good quantitative tests of strong field gravity. In particular, from the measured gravitational waves, it will be possible to measure multiple moments of the large black hole. So this is something that people have talked about for many, many years, and in the last few years, people have made this more quantitative about how one would actually do this. So let me remind you of the basic idea of how these measurements work. The basic idea is that one measures a gravitational wave over a period of, say, a year. And during that period, there'll be many, many cycles of gravitational waveform. And one has to construct a theoretical model of the gravitational wave and get it to match up with the observations. And one has, by integrating the template against the observation, one will have an accuracy in one's measurement that one will be able to measure the phase evolution to roughly one cycle in whatever the total number of cycles is. And so that gives you a potentially high accuracy of measurement. So one point of view is that one should just calculate what happens in general relativity for, say, the Kerr metric and see how well that matches the observations. But a more powerful point of view is to say, let's just assume an arbitrary axisymmetric stationary metric and see how well we can measure the various parameters that characterize this metric. So this has been done by Fenton Ryan in a paper in 1997, and these are his results. It's an approximate calculation in that it includes only the leading order effect on the waveform of the higher order multiples, not their exact effect. Because, of course, to calculate the radiation produced exactly in a metric with arbitrary multiples would be prohibitively difficult because the perturbation equations would not be separable. But the leading order effects are calculable and have been calculated, and this is what Fenton used to make his estimates. And so for the particular case of a 10 solar mass black hole spiraling into a 10 to the 5th solar mass supermassive black hole at a signal-to-noise ratio of 1,000, which is not unreasonable for LISA, these are the types of numbers that come out. So this, these quantities are the basically time parameters that characterize the waveform. This is the time of arrival of phase and the mass of the inspiraling object. And the rest of the parameters are characterizing the geometry of the space-time it's spiraling in, the mass of the object. And then these are the various mass and current multiple moments. And they're rescaled in this way from their conventional definitions to make them be dimensionless, and so that you would expect these parameters to be of order unity, so for a source that had no symmetries. This table shows the accuracy of measurement in, basically, it's the log to the base 10 of the relative accuracy of measurement. So negative numbers here, like this minus 5.8, says that you measure something to 6 digits. This direction down here corresponds to being more and more ambitious in one's data analysis and trying to measure more and more of these parameters that characterize the waves. And as you become more and more ambitious, you get less and less accuracy. But For instance, one can see here that if one goes up to this order, one can measure all of these parameters. The first non-trivial spin and a quadrupole type parameter with fairly high accuracy. And even when one goes up to higher orders, one can get these higher parameters to fairly good accuracy. And so I think the conclusion is that that this is sort of a real indication that there's good hope for this to become a real quantitative tool for measuring space-time geometries. This is really an illustrative calculation because it's approximate and because it's specialized to circular orbits in the equatorial plane, but it's really just to explore what the potential accuracies of measurement are. And so it's telling us that we can hope really to do quantitative measurements of space-time geometries of gravitational waves. Exactly, and that's the next point here. to make this kind of to be successful in extracting all the information from all the types of waves that we can detect of this type of a small object in spiraling supermassive black holes, we obviously need to have templates that are fully generic. We can't just calculate a simplified family of templates. And for such studies, it's necessary to understand the evolution of orbits in the Kerr metric under radiation reaction. And as many of you know, this subject has been, a lot of people have been working on this subject over the last years, in part motivated by this possibility. And the situation today, very briefly, is that the issues of principle have been resolved in a general context by work of a number of different groups, but that a practical calculational scheme for calculating radiation reaction for a generic orbit in the Kerr metric is still to be found. So there's a number of groups working on this, and at the Gravitational Wave Conference at Caltech in July, I noticed there's several aspects discussed, several abstracts that will discuss this issue, so hopefully progress is being made. Let me show over here various noise curves, and this is just to illustrate the degree to which these types of signals are detectable. This is roughly what you get for an inspiral and coalescence of two supermassive black holes at a redshift of order unity. So one gets a huge signal to noise with LISA, and for an object where a small, say, a 10 solar mass black hole spirals into a supermassive black hole at a redshift of order unity, one gets certainly it'll be detectable with LISA, but it's not a tremendous signal to noise ratio. Okay. Okay. What I'd like to do next is to raise some issues related to. Oh. Thanks. That's helpful. So
if. Curves like that to LIGO?
Yes, I have somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure if I have curves like this to LIGO right here. Okay. It's clear from this simple example that you get much more powerful waves when you have coalescence of comparable mass black holes. Of course, the difficulty, as you all know, is that this type of system is much more difficult to analyze than this type of system, because this type of system can be treated as a linear perturbation. And so it's much more easy to analyze. And this system is going to be much more difficult. And Richard Price is going to give us a talk during the conference about the status of numerical relativity calculations that are aimed towards understanding systems like these, particularly in the final stages. As a sort of a preview of that, I'd like to talk about some of the issues that people are currently grappling with. And to set the scene, I'm going to plot, I put here a plot of a what this signal might look roughly like for a particular example of an equal mass binary black hole coalescence. So this is a system of 100 solar masses, so 250 solar mass black holes, at a redshift of a half, and superimposed on the noise curves for LIGO 1 and LIGO 3. And roughly speaking, we have an inspiral portion to the signal, and then a complicated merger phase, which we don't really know what it looks like, and then a ring down, which we know what it looks like. So so what are the issues that people... So as you know, there are efforts from a variety of directions to try and understand in detail what the signal looks like, because it's obviously much more complicated than this simple model. So this regime, and also this ring down regime, are the domain of numerical relativity, and there have been a lot of efforts applying perturbation theory to the to the merger stage, the close limit approximation, and also to the ring down. The inspiral regime can be understood with post-Newtonian theory, and then there's a lot of theoretical work right now focusing on this regime, which is sort of intermediate between the post-Newtonian domain and the fully the domain which has to be treated by full numerical relativity. So that's one of the issues that perhaps could be discussed in the session afterwards. What are the prospects for computing templates in this regime, which people have called the intermediate binary black hole regime? Because this is sort of an important and pressing issue, because this is a regime where the length scales and time scales are sufficiently disparate that it's not feasible to use full numerical relativity. But it's also a regime where we're pretty confident that Newtonian and post-Newtonian approximations won't be good enough, and so there's a gap. And Kip Thorne and Patrick Brady and Jolien Creighton have put forward some suggestions as to how one might invent specialized numerical relativity techniques to deal with this gap. So I think that's sort of a key and important question that eventually will have to be sort of overcome. Another issue that comes up is, what's the location of the innermost stable circular orbit for two equal mass black holes? So we know for a test particle and for a non-spinning black hole that occurs at 6m with a corresponding frequency. But what happens then when one looks at equal mass black holes? This issue has been probed over the years by a variety of different methods, and the answers are kind of scattered. Let me show you what the answers are. So this is a table of what people have done over the years. I don't for estimating what the value of this innermost stable circular orbit is. So the dimensionless, there's a dimensionless number, which is the mass of the total system multiplied by the gravitational wave frequency corresponding to the innermost stable circular orbit, which is twice the orbital frequency. So this is a dimensionless number. So there are some calculations that were done several years ago. So one was a calculation by Kidder, Will, and Wiseman, which basically took post-Newtonian equations of motion and supplemented them with point particle, the terms that you get from the geodesic equation for point particle in Schwarzschild, so-called hybrid equations of motion. And using those equations of motion, they estimated a value of 0.02. Just for reference, the 6m value in these in this notation is 0.02, the innermost stable circular orbit in Schwarzschild. There was some work by Greg Cook and others at Cornell that looked at numerically generated initial data sets for general relativity and estimated, using sort of a hand-waving argument involving an effective potential, what the innermost stable circular orbit is. The problem here is one can generate numerically an initial data set, but how do you say what the masses of the two individual black holes are in your initial data set? They decided to use the areas of the event horizon. But does that really correspond to what would actually happen physically? And there are other sort of ambiguous questions like that that you can sort of make guesses as what one should do based on sort of Newtonian, post-Newtonian extrapolations, but it's not really firm. And so it's sort of an open question how good this approximation is, but it gets an answer that's different by over a factor of two from the other methods. There was some work several years ago by Detweiler using a variational principle and again looking at periodics, looking at something similar to initial data sets, but actually periodic solutions to the Einstein equations, where he gets an answer of 0.06, similar to this value, but because he was using a variational principle, and it wasn't clear that he was getting the best bound from his variational principle. And there's also more recent work of Detweiler. More recently, there's been a suggestion by Damur, Iyer, and Sathya Prakash of a way of improving the accuracy of pulse Newtonian templates, which is to use a method called Paddy approximants. And it's been shown that this using this technique really improves the accuracy of pulse Newtonian templates when you specialize to the limit of a small mass ratio. And it's sort of expected then that would also work well for comparable masses. And they get an answer that's closer to the Kidder-Willen-Wiseman value, but a factor of maybe 50% different. And so the sort of the outstanding issue is, can we find a better way to calculate this? Which of these methods should be believed, and so on and so forth? And what other methods could we come up with? So a next issue I want to focus on, that's sort of an outstanding issue, is what's the total amount of energy radiated in this type of process in the most extreme case? So there'll obviously be a distribution of total energy radiated depending on the initial conditions, the mass ratio, the spins of the black holes, the orientations of the spins. But let's focus on, so let's say the strongest 1% of the sources. What do we expect the efficiency of radiation to be? What's the total energy radiated divided by the total mass of the space-time? This particular plot here has sort of an optimistic estimate based on sort of hand-waving Newtonian-type argument estimates. It assumes a total energy radiated of order 10%. There are numerical simulations where you start with a distorted black hole and you let it evolve and you see what the total energy radiated is. And there are simulations of that nature that see radiated energies, total radiated energies of about 3%. So certainly several percent is not unreasonable. But there's recent work based on the close limit approximation and linear perturbation theory that Richard will probably tell us about in detail in his talk, that suggests that the total energy radiated is not larger than about 1%. And this subject is already the subject matter of a bet between, I think, Kip and Richard Price. And so I think this would be a useful thing to talk about in the discussion section. What are the... maybe we'll get some more bets going or something. Okay. The next source I want to talk about is a very speculative source, but not completely ruled out. So the people working in classical general relativity have not yet succeeded in proving in full generality cosmic censorship. Most of us believe, of course, that cosmic censorship is true because of the huge variety of circumstantial evidence from various different directions. But because of the fact that the theorem has not been proved, we're free to speculate that it's false and ask what the possible consequences are. So it's certainly possible, although, as I said, extremely unlikely going by the evidence, that the formation of a black hole and gravitational collapse or the merger of two black holes could produce a naked singularity. So what would the observational consequences of that be if it were true? You would expect, roughly speaking, that because you're seeing regions of dynamic and very, very high curvature, that the associated frequency scale of the radiation that you're seeing should be associated with a much, much higher curvature scale. So very crudely, you might expect to see radiation at frequencies going from the mass of the black hole, the reciprocal of the mass of the black hole, which normally acts as an effective upper bound, roughly speaking, for the frequency scales of radiation, all the way up to the Planck mass. So that's sort of at the outside what you might expect. And you can ask, what would this imply? If once there was a coalescence of two solar mass black holes, and it produced a naked singularity, the radiation then would typically be at frequencies that would be too high to observe with ground-based detectors. So it wouldn't really be interesting. The interesting possibility is if there's a detected merger of supermassive black holes, and if that's detected with ground-based or optical means, or with space-based gravitational detectors and or optical means, but it's also seen quite strongly in high-frequency detectors. If this was the case, this would be some evidence that there's very, very high curvature phenomena taking place, and that might be some experimental evidence for a violation of cosmic censorship. So I think this illustrates one of the strengths of gravitational wave astronomy. It potentially falsifies some of the things that we think are true.
Mm-hmm. On the lower end of that frequency range, mm-hmm. isn't that roughly the frequency of, you know, very relativistic orbit just before plunging into the black hole?
Yes, that's true.
Isn't I thought that LIGO was designed to be able to see those frequencies for stellar mass black holes.
Well, let's see, how does this work? So LIGO can see objects in spiraling around a supermassive, or LIGO can see the sort of in spiral of equal mass black holes, but then at the last stages, it's up in this sort of high frequency region, and it's much, much harder to see. If one makes one of the black holes slightly massive, around 100 or a few hundred solar masses, then the interesting, very relativistic regime is in here, which is much more interesting. And so that's a possibility that people sometimes hope for. But most processes involving supermassive black holes are just out of LIGO's bandwidth. And so if there was a process like this that was detected, and we also saw, we didn't see the radiation stop here, but we saw it spread all the way over here, then that would be an indication of something funny going on. Okay.
If you look at your curve where you show the merger, merger waves, of course, are seeable by LIGO at 2-10 solar mass black holes.
Yes.
So
okay. So it's not quite true to say they're not observable. That's right. That was a bit of an exaggeration. Okay. The next issue I'd like to focus on is what can we learn about tests of general relativity, and what can we usefully deduce about when we compare general relativity to other theories of gravity from gravitational observations. One of the most useful sources in this regard is in-spiraling compact binaries. And so here I've drawn a little cartoon of the signal and the source, and this is what I mentioned before, that if one measures any parameter that influences the rate of in-spiral and correspondingly the evolution of the phase of the waves, then the fractional accuracy with which that parameter is measured scales like 1 over the number of cycles, which is of order 10 to the 4 for in-spiraling binaries, and so one gets a potential high accuracy. So it's already been shown by Cliff Will that this, the possibility of making these measurements when the measurements are made will give us significant new experimental constraints. So one limit is on the quote graviton mass. So if one assumes a standard dispersion relation for a massive particle and assumes that for gravitons, then one will be able to deduce, so that would change the phasing of the waves, and one can deduce then a lower bound on what the associated length scale is. We have order 10 to the 12 kilometers for LIGO, 10 to the 16 kilometers for LISA, both of these are better than existing bounds. But this, you should put in an important caveat here, is that there's really no good theoretical framework in which the graviton has a mass. And so we shouldn't really call this a measurement of a graviton mass, but we should probably call it something else. Cliff Will has also shown that analyzing these systems in the framework of Brown's sticky theory allows you to put a limit on the dimensionless parameter of that theory, which is better than that obtained from solar system bounds using neutron star black hole binaries. Here the way it works is that in these theories the scalar gravitational field can carry dipolar radiation, and that becomes an important energy loss mechanism that competes with the quadrupole mechanism. So here one can constrain these theories of gravity with scalar fields, not by detecting the scalar component of the gravitational waves directly, but by constraining their indirect effects. A little bit more detail on that, let me describe some recent work of Damour and Esposito-Ferez. So the context of this work is to write down a general scalar tensor theory of gravity with one scalar field, which is sort of a theoretically natural way of generalizing general relativity. And this is two free functions, a potential function and a coupling function. So this is written in the Einstein frame. And as is well known, there are two ways in which a theory like this can be consistent with experiments we know so far. Either the scalar field has to be massive, so that at the sort of cosmological value phi zero of the scalar field, there's some non-zero mass, and the mass scale has to be smaller than the length scale has to be smaller than about a millimeter, which is the length scale to which Newton's law has been probed. So that's one scenario. The other scenario is that it's massless, so you can throw away the potential, but then the coupling has to be very weak, and specifically this derivative of this function A, this alpha, which is essentially alpha squared is essentially 1 over omega in terms of Brown's sticky omega, has to be less than of order 10 to the minus 3. So this is basically the parameterized post-Newtonian type parameter that have been constrained by solar system bounds. So DeMoor and Esposito-Ferez have generalized Tiff-Wills' work by looking at a particular example of a scalar tensor theory with vanishing potential and a particular coupling function that has two parameters, alpha and alpha 0 and beta 0. And let me show you what they get. This is the constraints on these two parameters that we get just from measurements before gravitational waves. Lunar laser ranging here and there. Mercury's perihelion shift here. New measurements of the bending of radio waves using VLBI give you this constraint. And analysis of the binary pulsar tells you have to be to the right of this line. So all of these are, of course, compatible general relativity's value. And so what can gravitational waves do in this context? So this plot shows the same thing as before. This is the allowed region. But now it shows the constraints coming from some of the other binary pulsars. This is the constraint coming from the binary pulsar 1534 plus 12. It has to be below this dotted line. And also a constraint coming from this other pulsar. And detecting a neutron star black hole binary with LIGO would constrain you to lie below this line. So in the context of this specific model, the conclusion is that you wouldn't learn anything new with gravitational wave detections that's not already implied by the binary pulsars. But that conclusion is specific to this specific model. 5 minutes, okay. Let me go through very quickly some recent developments in periodic sources. So periodic sources are principally rotating neutron stars. And these stars can radiate by three mechanisms. The first is a misalignment of the axis of rotation with a principal axis of the moment of inertia tensor. Such radiation would quickly damp away because of the gravitational wave emission, and so could only be significant if it was continually excited. The second mechanism is a non-axisymmetry of the star. And in that case, the effective amplitude would be roughly of this value, and it depends crucially on this dimensionless parameter, the so-called eccentricity parameter. And it also varies strongly with frequency. And then, of course, there's modes of oscillation of the star, which we heard all about from John Friedman. So what are the recent developments? Aside from the recent stuff about the oscillation modes, there are two things that are worth mentioning. The first is there are new ideas in data analysis that have sort of solved some problems that have been around for a long time. If you asked the question several years ago, how well can I place a limit on the dimensionless amplitude H in, say, an all-sky, all-frequency search, then with a computer with processing power of 1 teraflop, you basically are a factor of 3 to 5 worse than the ideal limit with an infinitely fast computer. And that comes from having to do Doppler corrections for all lots and lots of different patches in the sky. And this factor of 3 to 5 doesn't seem huge, but remember, you have to cube that factor to get an event rate. So it's a potentially significant factor. And due now to a number of ideas by Patrick Brady, Julian Creighton, Kirk Kuttler, Bernie Schutz, Maria Alessandra Papa, and a number of other people that have combined a number of different sort of creative ideas together for doing the data analysis, this number has now gone down to 1.5. So I don't have time to describe all the ideas, but if any of you are interested, I encourage you to go on the web and look at the papers that these people have written. But there are a number of different interlocking ideas for how to get past this problem. Another new development is what we think now about low-mass X-ray binaries. So many of these binaries are now observed to spin at frequencies near 300 Hertz by the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer, by the quasi-periodic oscillations. And it's now sort of believed to be sort of possible that in these systems, accretion spin-up is balancing gravitational wave spin-down. And that's what actually limits the rotation spin of the system. So just to clarify things, in John's talk, there was discussed the possibility of these systems being balanced, of this type of balance occurring because of an unstable mode being excited. This is different. This is when no unstable modes are excited, but the balance is just due to some non-axisymmetry in the star, just this mechanism here. And so this balancing requires some mechanism for non-axisymmetry. One particular mechanism was suggested by Lars Boston involving non-uniform temperatures over the surface of the star, which leads then to a non-uniform density over the surface of the star. The particular mechanism he suggested was later shown not to work, but I understand that that he and Kurt Kuttler have found a slightly different variant of the method that still basically predicts this required amount of non-axisymmetry. Okay. How many more minutes? Okay, let me, all right. The last few minutes of my talk I'm going to spend talking about stochastic gravitational waves. So these are sources that we are ignorant about the sources, and so we have to describe them statistically. And many types of sources, to a good approximation, are fairly simple. They're Gaussian, stationary, homogeneous, and isotropic, and so they're characterized by this quantity that we discussed earlier, the spectrum. There are two different characters of sources. One character is a superposition of many discrete astrophysical sources. People have discussed supernova, coalescing binary, spinning neutron stars, and black hole formation. And depending on these sort of backgrounds can be detectable according to the estimates that people have made for these types of sources. More interesting sources are stuff that's produced in the very early universe. Relic gravitational waves from the earliest epochs of the Big Bang, gravitational waves produced by inflation, phase transitions, and cosmic strings. And what I'd like to do in the last few minutes is just try and give you a sense of how much potential there is for one particular mechanism production, which is this well-known parametric amplification mechanism. The basic idea is that if one takes the gravitational wave Mechic perturbation, it satisfies a harmonic oscillator wave equation with a time-dependent frequency, and it acts like a pump field and pumps energy into the mode. And there's a well-known mechanism that tells you that a large number of quanta are produced in a situation where you have rapid expansion in the early universe. And basically, the spectrum is directly related to the scale factor for any mode, is directly related to the scale factor of two different epochs. The scale factor which a mode leaves the horizon and re-enters the horizon. And so in principle, at least, this is a very powerful probe of early universe cosmology. If we measure this, we can basically map out how the scale factor evolves. The conventional viewpoint here is that these waves are not detectable. This is what it roughly looks like. Here's my other part. The conventional viewpoint is that these waves are not detectable for the following reason. The current dominant paradigm in early universe cosmology is slow roll inflation. And the prediction of slow roll inflation is something like this. This is actually what you get for exact exponential inflation, which is sort of the limiting case of slow roll inflation. It's exactly flat, and by matching the spectrum up with our upper bound from cosmic microwave background measurements, we see we can't measure with either LIGO or LISA, but this looks suspiciously close. But if you analyze it in more detail in slow roll inflation models, Mike Turner's done an analysis where he shows that you actually shouldn't assume that all of the cosmic microwave background signal is due to gravitational waves, and there's some contribution due to scalar perturbation, so this should be down a little bit. The amount by which it's down is model dependent, but it's actually correlated with a slight tilting of this graph. And if you make the gravitational wave signal higher here, it has the effect of tilting this down here, which hurts you. And so it turns out that when you actually feed in the correlations with the normalization and the tilt, you actually do about an order of magnitude worse than the simplest model. So it looks like it's not detectable. But again, that's only in this dominant paradigm of slow roll inflation. And there are a lot of different scenarios in which, for the early universe, which would give detectable gravitational waves via this mechanism. So first of all, the dominant paradigm assumes that the modes of the graviton field are in the ground state at the start of inflation. And that assumes you know what's going on in sort of the Planck epoch, the quantum gravity epoch, and that may very well turn out not to be the case. Another thing that's not very well known is the dynamical extra dimensions that arise in string theory and in Kluze-Klein theories. If they're dynamical, they drive the graviton modes of the pump field, just like the scale factor of the overall universe drives the graviton mode. So early in the universe, if the extra dimensions are dynamical, that would create a gravitational wave signature. Then there are a couple of different explicit scenarios that people have worked on that are compatible with measurements and that could give rise to detectable signature. Okay, so let me come to my conclusion. The transparencies I'm skipping over are the prospects for detecting gravitational waves via the measurements of the cosmic microwave background. The bottom line is it might be possible with the most advanced satellite, I think it's the Planck satellite. It might just barely be possible to actually distinguish between gravitational waves and scalar perturbations. But the overall summary is that realistic gravitational waves are probably our best window onto relativistic gravitational fields, and there are really a lot of possibilities for fundamental discoveries.
Okay, let's begin with questions directly on the talk.
Very simple question. What do you think the chances are that something unmistakable will really be seen by LIGO in its first year?
I wouldn't bet my life on it. I think it's certainly conceivable. I wouldn't be surprised if it happens. I mean, there are precedents where people have looked in new windows. An example is, was it X-rays or something, where somebody wrote a paper claiming that the brightest objects that you would see in X-rays would be the sun, and so there was no point in putting up such and such a satellite. But of course it was put up and the paper was completely wrong. And so I would say that I wouldn't be surprised if we turned out to be more ignorant than we had realized, and you know there were stronger sources than we had realized, or the event rates were wrong. But I don't have any reason to be very confident that it'll detect something in the first year.
Let's extend that now. So LIGO 2 involves modest enhancements, nothing radically different, just doing a bunch of things better, and you show it doing a search around the 2004 time frame. Do you think of the odds that LIGO 2 will see sources?
You're asking me? I would say based on what we know from coalescing binaries, I would say the odds are good, better than even. The coalescing binaries, I think, are the most promising thing. Or perhaps the coalescing binary neutron stars, perhaps systems involving black holes. So I think the odds are good for that. Yes?
And when are we in trouble?
Pardon?
When are we in trouble?
In terms of... I think I'll have to adopt that question.
I would say one's in serious trouble in LIGO 3. LIGO 3 is at a level where even under the most conservative of estimates that anyone has, astrophysicists have made, you really should be seeing things. What's in trouble then is something about people's conventional wisdom about the astrophysical universe.
So LIGO 3, you're saying you should, conventional understanding means conventional understanding of number of neutron star binaries.
For example, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the source we know the best.
Yeah.
And LIGO 3 should be able to see that out to something approaching a gigaparsec. And the most ultra-conservative estimates that anybody has made is say that you should be seeing a few per year at that level. So I think it's fair to say LIGO 2, I would agree with Aina that the odds are better than 50-50. I'd say they're considerably better than 50-50. And LIGO 3 is where you have to go rethink some things that are fairly deeply believed by astrophysicists. I don't think you're forced to rethink gravitation theory.
Abhay?
Since LIGO 2 is more straightforward, quote unquote straightforward, improvement of the first aspect, because in just stick with LIGO 2, could you summarize for us the ups and downs that have been going on, the event rates for the neutron star, for this, and now this thing about what are things like the first event and what's the first part?
Yes. That's true. So what happened there was that... okay, so the question is to summarize what's the current state of astrophysical event rate estimates for neutron star binaries, which is sort of the most promising source. I think it's true that the current best estimates of the event rate are somewhat worse than they were several years ago, but the uncertainties are still very large. So the specific thing you refer to is the fact that the event rate is arrived at by trying to do statistical analysis of the three different binary pulsars that we see that will merge within a Hubble time. And the event rate estimate is actually dominated just by two of them because of their distances from us. And one of those, the distance was recently measured to be 50% further away than had been thought. And so that decreased the expected event rate let's see.
There's a reanalysis unpublished by Ramesh Narayan and Joe Taylor, which they did as members of the Hartle Committee. The results of their analysis will appear, I am told, in the Hartle Committee report, which, as far as I'm aware, is embargoed by the National Academy of Sciences at the moment. Is that correct? Is Jim Hart here? Maybe he's not. Anyway, talking privately with Narayan, what he tells me is that basically they found effects such as not having done quite right the statistics of small numbers, where the data are coming from very small numbers of sources, that pushed it back up so that their current estimate is at about the same level as the original Narayan and Finney estimates of 1991.
Which is what for LIGO 2?
So for LIGO 2, LIGO 2 is likely to be done in two steps, that is, two pieces of enhancements. And so by the time you've done the second step, that would be giving you event rates that are something like 10 a year. But at the first step, it's probably a little less than one a year. So LIGO 2, as I say, but the plans for precisely what is done when in LIGO 2 are not yet made. They're under discussion, and we'll be more clear about that by this autumn. But nothing is published on this. Vicky Caligara is giving a talk at the Amaldi conference at Caltech in early July, where she will go through this in great detail. She's a postdoc with Narayan at the moment.
And what about this intermediate mass black hole? What is the general LIGO 30?
Well, I would say we're very excited about the possibility because it's really a type of source that would be perfect for LIGO. It would it basically takes the very relativistic gravitational regime which you really want to study and moves it down into the bandwidth where you have good sensitivity. So, but I think the consensus in the astrophysics community, at least according to Roger Blanford, is that this is one possible interpretation of the data, and it's not really conclusive. So I don't know any more than that about what the likelihood is of it being.
I'd like to add a comment to what you said about naked singularity. Mm-hmm. Some work that we did suggest that the collapse ends in a naked singularity, and quantum pair creation analogous to Hawking radiation is also going to be very significant.
Okay.
Quantum black hole evaporates extremely slowly. A quantum naked singularity appears to evaporate much faster.
I see.
Because the curve is exposed gravitational regions are much stronger.
I see.
And probably that aspect will also be significant in
yes.
estimating.
Right. Is that published yet?
There are some results actually show instability of the Gaussian riser and a divergence plus pairs riser. But then one has to do back reaction to actually get some more details out.
I see. Yes?
You mentioned something that I haven't heard, that the initial Goldstone mechanism was producing an axisymmetric deformation for the neutron star for getting the stones. It doesn't work. And that there's a revived version by covering Goldstone. Can you describe what went wrong and what is the
okay. The question is that I mentioned a suggestion by Lars Bilston to explain the origin of the non-axisymmetry in LOMAS X-ray binaries. And I said that the original published version of this mechanism was later found not to work, but that it was later fixed up. I think I actually can't remember the details.
I think the issue is in the original mechanism, they had a quadrupole moment produced not terribly deep inside the star. And the strength of the material is such, on looking at it closer, that the more massive region tends to sink faster than might have originally been guessed. But after going through it in much greater detail, Cutler, Bilstein, and Ushimirsky, Greg, who's a student of Bilstein, find they still do get numbers out that are of the right size, but the inhomogeneities are more complicated and much more deeply seated in the star. So it's a change of detail, but not a change of results. I just happen to know this because Greg Ushimirsky was at Caltech yesterday telling us about it. So they have a paper that is to be submitted very soon covering it.
Yeah,
so you explained that one needs to construct these templates in order to hope to take the signal out of the package. And I can imagine that with a lot of work and combining interpretive and numerical methods, it's supposed to construct these templates, assuming just sort of straight general relativity. But my impression of astrophysics is that things are often very dirty. There's all sorts of complicated, things around that we don't usually, might be hard to take into account. So is one worried that especially since you need accuracy, the temperature is very high. So is one worried about this other influence, not higher order GR effects, but just other dirty things that might be making the system more complicated?
That is a worry. So people thought about this a lot in the context of neutron stars. People have really gone through all of the various things, tidal interactions, magnetic fields, lots of different things. And basically, the conclusion has been that for the in-spiral, to very high accuracy, it's equivalent to two-point particles interacting in full general relativity with spin, so spinning point particles. And the essential reason, roughly speaking, that this comes out to be the case for neutron stars is first that the neutron stars are very compact, right? They're relativistic. But second, that the amount of energy involved in sort of the gravitational interaction is huge. I mean, in the relative regime, it's of order, percent of the solar mass. It's a huge amount of energy. And it's the timescales are short compared with most other astrophysical processes. It's just, a question of what the magnitudes are. I don't know if people have thought about it in detail in the context of a small object moving into inspiring into a larger black hole. Now, one complicating influence is the fact that initially it's expected that these objects will be kicked into a very elliptical orbit from this star cluster. And in that case, it's expected there will still be interactions with the stars in the star cluster. And that's the reason, actually, why people focus on 10 solar mass black holes, which is a lesser effect than things like, 1.4 solar mass neutron stars, where that's more significant. And so people have worried about that. I'm not actually... I don't know of any other... physical effects that people think are important there is one other effect, which is the interaction of a if there's an accretion disk around the supermassive black hole, then one's possibility that the inspiring object, you know, repeatedly goes through the accretion disk. And so that is a worry. I'm not sure if people really shown that that's going to be unimportant.
Now, there's a paper supposedly in the writing stages now by Ramesh Narayan, where Narayan and the community around him think they have argued strongly, maybe there are people here who can comment on it, but have argued rather strongly that most massive black holes and galactic nuclei have so-called ADAP disks, accretion-dominated flow disks, or advection-dominated accretion flow disks. And these disks have such low mass densities in them that according to Narayan's calculation, which he's supposed to be writing up, they would not produce any noticeable effect in the LISA data analysis for inspiring neutron stars or black holes, and likely not even for inspiring white dwarfs. So it's quite promising if the disks are really of the sort that he argues most of them are.
I don't know if I missed it, but among your sources, you mentioned cosmic streams and intersecting those.
It was briefly on One Transparency, but I was very behind time, so I didn't dwell on it. But I mean,
so it's for example, would we be able to pull out, for example, that as a model for
I think LIGO will definitively be able to rule out that scenario, but I think there's sort of a consensus, not 100%, but a sort of a consensus that it's already been ruled out by comparison with the power spectrum that you predict on large scale, that you see on galaxy surveys on very, very large scales. I don't think there's quite a consensus, but I think there's almost a consensus. The other point, though, is that even if it's true that cosmic strings are not responsible for, say, galaxy formation, the structure at large scales, it's still possible that they're there at some weaker level. And LIGO can actually see, I think the predicted signal for LIGO, when you assume that cosmic strings are responsible for structure formation, is about three orders of magnitude higher than the LIGO sensitivity. So if cosmic strings are there with a mass unit length much smaller than the conventional GUTs, then it would still be detectable. Also, it's almost been ruled out by the binary pulsar, or the limits from pulsar timing. Yes?
The first stochastic magma measurement shows that we have
the trouble
with the
binary. Yeah, that's right. That is a big. So the question is for attempting to measure stochastic gravitational waves with the LISA. It is true that it will be a big problem that there will be a large number of signals from white dwarf binaries in our galaxy, and there will be so many of them that it's thought that it won't be possible to resolve them individually, and it will basically mean that you can't, it will be a source of noise in the detector. So this is sort of something that people have thought about for a long time, but more recently now people have been thinking about analogous issues for LIGO, and it's sort of a worry that LIGO's ability to probe gravitational waves coming from very early in the universe might be impeded by just more mundane stuff that went on more recently in the universe, like spinning neutron stars and supernova. And so if you detect a gravitational wave background with LIGO, then it's possible that it could from some of these other sources and not from very early universe stuff. So it would be nice to detect gravitational waves coming from, say, spinning neutron stars or supernovas, you know, from a superposition of very, very many of these sources going out to redshift of relativity unity, but it would be kind of a shame if that is eventually what happened and it prevents us from seeing what goes on earlier in the universe, which is a possibility. Which it's another argument for why we should pursue gravitational wave astronomy in as many frequency bands as we can.
Let me ask a question. The numerical relativity community, as I think Richard Price will discuss tomorrow, is not likely to have the binary black hole merger problem totally under control by the time you start doing searches for gravitational waves from these things with LIGO 1. That means that the searches cannot be informed by theoretically based templates, and one will have to use other techniques. I know you've been involved in exploring other techniques. The most promising other technique, as far as I'm aware, is an excess power technique that you've devised. How much, what's the current conclusion as to how much signal to noise will be lost because we don't have theory-based templates and are forced to use these other techniques, and corresponding, what event rate loss will there be?
I think, roughly speaking, you do very well with these excess power techniques. That, roughly speaking, you lose maybe a factor of order 50% in signal to noise, corresponding to a factor of a few in event rate.
A few means 8. 50% 1. Mean 1.5 or 0.5?
1.5.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's a factor of 1.5 cubed. So
that's
2.
That's
three, about a factor of 3 in event rate.
That's right. Okay. But then another issue is that...
And is that true? Suppose that the signals, the strongest signals are, I would have guessed, from systems where the black holes have large spins more or less parallel to their orbital angular momentum. So they've got a lot of excess angular momentum they've got to get rid of in order to actually merge. And in that case, you could have, say, 30 cycles or so of merger waves, conceivably. Is it, you still think your excess power technique can get it with just a loss of a factor of 3 in event rate?
I think, let's see, the number I quoted of about 50% is when the number of independent frequency events, so your mm-hmm. product of your time duration times your frequency dimension, which roughly speaking is the same as under cycle, that when that is between, say, 50 and 200, something like that. So,
okay.
So I think there shouldn't be a huge loss. But I think even if it's one is successful, also, well, one should add a caveat, though, that these analyses are based on Gaussian noise, and that this technique will probably be particularly susceptible to non-Gaussian noise, and so it might be somewhat worse when you include the effect of the non-Gaussian noise. The other caveat is that even if one can detect these waves using this technique, one really doesn't learn very much. You might have a situation where you have a statistical inference to some signal in your detector, but you might not be able to actually draw a graph of what the signal is because it's too noisy, that your fidelity in signal reconstruction would be really low, and that you wouldn't be able to learn anything about black hole coalescences. Whereas if you had a complete family of templates, you basically project everything onto a much, much lower dimensional space, increase your fidelity in your measurement, and actually start learning something about black hole coalescences. So I think there's still enormous importance attached to finding, you know, templates. Yes?
Is there a source of human problems for the supermassive black holes themselves
to do so? I think that's very, very, let's see. For the mergers of supermassive black holes, those would be relatively rare events.
Yes.
And so it's believed that there wouldn't be a confusion problem. For the
stars
falling in, it is true that there would be many of those processes on at once. But the way those processes work is that over a time scale of years, the duration of the experiment, you slowly see the in-spiral proceed, and you'll see many, many of these types of sources that are maybe 100 years or so, or several hundred years from its final merger, and maybe a few that you'll actually see fall right in. And so basically, even despite the fact that there are many on at once, one hopes to be able to distinguish them in the frequency domain. Yes?
What would be the time lag between when the data, say, if LIGO detects something and enough analyses will be made so that one can say that something has been distinguished or
not? Well, let's see. There will be some part of the data analysis will be sort of automated and online, and that will be effectively instantaneous. For the very first detection, I'm imagining that there'll be quite a substantial time lag because we'll have to go...
Years?
I would guess months. I would guess months, something like that.
The COBE detection of the anisotropy, they sat on that and argued about it for a time of order a year. I don't know precisely what that time was before they finally agreed to publish it and agreed on how to publish it. And I think it wouldn't be at all surprising if it's similar here. Let me just ask about something you did not discuss, which is neutron star black hole binaries. There have been estimates by several different groups recently of event rates, one by Stan Woosley and colleagues. Woosley tends to be a rather conservative astrophysicist, a little more optimistic, but not terribly different estimates by Beta and Brown. And they are saying, agreeing that the event rate for neutron star black hole binaries in LIGO 2 should be significantly higher than for neutron star binaries. So the issue I wonder if you could comment on is that for neutron star black hole binaries, if the black hole has a moderate spin, then the orbit is not in the equatorial plane. The orbit, of course, will precess. The precession of the orbit then is wonderful because it brings you some nice information about the black hole spin and such, but it's also a problem for data analysis. Can you comment on the issue of finding these kinds of sources, which it now looks like could well be the strongest source?
I agree that this is sort of a very important issue that needs to be resolved. I think the current status is that the work that's been done on this has been by Harris Apostolatos, work on constructing templates in a certain regime of the parameter space where we can analytically understand the effect of this precession. And Harris finds that that there'll be a large portion of the parameter space where we'll be able to detect precession, but there's also a piece of the parameter space where we cannot. And because of that, I think this is one of the sort of the key theoretical sort of computational issues that needs to be resolved and pushed forward.
And then let me just probe on one other issue before we quit. I know you were going to talk about what can be done from CMBR, cosmic microwave background observations, to learn about gravity waves. Could you just briefly give an overview of the issue of using polarization to do that?
So the situation is that there are three different levels in which you can attempt to distinguish between tensor and scalar perturbations from the measured cosmic microwave background anisotropies. The first level is ignoring polarization. Just look at the spectrum that you see, you know, the graphs people always draw, and then compare that to your theoretical predictions, and with scalar and tensor perturbations both included, and see what you get. The problem with that is for the conventional models, the contribution from tensor perturbations dies off very rapidly after about a multiple of L equals 30. And so it's very hard to distinguish because the cosmic variance is very large at lower multiples but high at high multiples. So that's really not a very feasible way to detect the gravitational wave contribution. The current data that we have so far doesn't distinguish between, if you assume the spectrum of the tensor and scalar perturbations are both flat in the conventional sense, and you ask what's the ratio between them and their contribution to the quadrupole, then that ratio, that dimensionless number, could be anywhere between 0 and about 2 or 3, according to the current data. So it's not constrained yet. That's when you do an analysis, assuming these two spectra are flat. So the next level is when you look at polarization information, because, again, if you make predictions in different models, the prediction from the prediction of the contributions from the scalar and tensor pieces to the polarization information is different. What you measure with polarization is essentially a two-dimensional symmetric tensor over a sphere. It's basically sort of the statistical properties of the polarization over the sky. And so the next level you can try to do is just measure this polarization information and use that to try and disentangle the two components. At that level, the status, as far as I understand it, is that the projections are that the most advanced satellite, So again, the whether or not you can disentangle now depends on what theory you're talking about. But we're in the context of the conventional sterile inflation. As far as I understand, the most advanced satellite, I think it's the later one, which I think is Planck, will just be at a level where it can start to make that distinction. Then there's a third level, which people have noticed recently, which is the fact that if you look at this polarization observable, you can split it up into two components, something like a axial and polar component. It's basically a tensor field and a sphere. And it turns out that one of these, the axial component, is only contains contributions from the tensor perturbations and no contributions from the scalar perturbations, for the same kind of reasons John was explaining. And so if one can measure that component, that gives you an unambiguous and model-independent way of measuring gravitational waves. The problem is that component, again, in the conventional model, the predicted amplitude of that particular component is very, very small. So people are sort of excited about this prospect, but it's not immediately useful in the context of the model that people are talking about now. But in principle, and if other models turn out to be correct, that could be an important way of going ahead.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, thank you, Anna.